Tomorrow's Super Tuesday, Texas Democrats, do you know where your ballot will go? A conversation with voters who still call themselves undecided today on the Texas Standard.
Texas Standard is a production of KUT Austin, KERA North Texas, Houston Public Media, and Texas Public Radio in San Antonio, with support from Rand Group, software delivered as promised. No surprises.
I'm David Brown in the Texas Standard Newsroom. Despite big spending by the Democratic candidates in Texas, including rallies, robocalls, and door-to-door canvassing, many Texas Democrats say they're still not sure who they'll vote for tomorrow. We'll hear how they're doing the political math. Plus, fear fueling a major price drop in a clash between the Texas energy industry and the coronavirus. Those stories and a whole lot more when the Texas Standard gets underway right after this. No matter where you are, it's Texas Standard time on this second day of March 2020. I'm David Brown. Great to have you with us. You know, historically in Texas, more people vote early than on Election Day. And according to the Texas Tribune, which kept a running tally through Friday in the 10 largest counties in Lone Star State, more Texans voted early this year than in the past presidential cycle. A total of 1,113,726 Texans cast ballots between February 18th and February 28th. That includes 691,000 Democrats and 421,000 Republicans. Now, again, these are just the 10 largest counties, which account for nearly 60% of the total number of registered voters. But if you have not yet voted, you have one more day tomorrow, a day known nationwide as Super Tuesday. What might cause a voter to wait until the last possible day to cast a ballot? Well, one factor we are discovering is that among Texans who plan to vote in the Democratic primary, there are plenty of them who still call themselves undecided. And if you're thinking that after all the debates, the ads on TV and online, the incessant robocalls and text messages, there can't possibly be anyone left who's undecided, well, allow us to introduce you to a small sampling of people still trying to make up their minds what they'll do when they cast their ballot in the presidential primaries tomorrow. Rachel Anthony lives in Plano, Texas. Rachel, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Yes, I can. Good morning.
Good morning. Welcome to the Texas Standard. We have Rob Hughes, who is in Richardson, Texas. Rob, good morning.
Good morning.
And we have John Hawthorne Smith, who's come into the studio because he lives right here in the Texas capital city. Good to see you, John.
Thank you for having me.
All right. So the field of choices has gotten smaller. We have Pete Buttigieg, who has ended his campaign. So has Tom Steyer. This after Joe Biden pulled off a victory in South Carolina over the weekend. Let me ask you first, Rachel, does the narrowing of the field make any difference for you?
I feel like it makes it a little bit easier. I was leaning towards Buttigieg, but now that he is completely out, now it seems like it's just the top three between Warren, Biden, and Sanders.
Warren, Biden, and Sanders is what it comes down to. What about you, John? Where have you been in all this?
I started as a Warren supporter, but I'm definitely unsure at this point. So I think the winnowing of the field has helped. And I think that as we get closer, hopefully something will shift in the next 24 hours.
Rob, does any of this sound like the way you've been thinking about things, or have you been looking at it differently?
No, that's pretty much it. I mean, my base calculation is who wins the general plus can boost down ballot candidates.
I want to pursue that just a little bit because, you know, Biden's victory on Saturday makes him the overall leader in the popular vote. That's 30,000 more votes than Bernie Sanders, although Sanders still leads Biden in the delegate count by 8. I want to stick with you for just a moment here, Rob, because I'm wondering what's you talk about that general election as a Democratic voter. If you vote in the Democratic primary, I should say. Is it more important that you vote for a candidate you think can beat Donald Trump in November, or is it about voting for a candidate who shares your view on the issues?
At this point, it's mainly about beating Trump.
So it doesn't matter if the person is, say, a little bit too far to the left for your liking, or what?
Well, that makes it a little bit tougher because policy is always extremely important to me. But right now, I look at what the administration is doing and has done, and I'm mostly at a point of step one, get them out, step to figure out where to go from there.
So where does that leave you as you look toward pulling the lever in the voting booth tomorrow?
Right now I'm going back and forth between Elizabeth Warren and Joe Biden.
I could
vote for Sanders in the general, but there's a lot of things that I've seen in him over his congressional career that makes me think that he would not be worse for the country. But
when you say he, who are you referring to?
Sorry, Sanders.
Sanders, okay.
All right. Bernie Sanders. But my biggest concern with Bernie Sanders is that from what I've seen in the past, he will not be helpful down ballot.
Rachel, how do you see this? Is it more important picking someone who lines up with your values, or is it more important finding someone who can defeat Donald Trump?
Well, I think all the top three candidates, Warren, Biden, and Sanders, I do share similar interests and, you know, like their policies and platforms, of course. Sanders is a little more to the left than how I view things. So I'm okay with their platforms and stuff. It is pretty much beating Donald Trump and taking back the White House, but I'm afraid if Sanders does get the nomination, like Rob was saying, it's going to hurt down ballot Democrat. And, you know, it doesn't matter if we have someone as progressive as Sanders in the White House, if we can't get control of the House or the Senate or even both, I mean, what are we actually going to be able to accomplish to undo everything that Trump has put, you know, forth and passed when it comes to immigration and our clean air and clean water, that sort of thing. And so that's what worries me. I just want to put somebody in there that will maybe not be such a, I don't know, like have people make a knee-jerk reaction when they see, you know, Sanders, and they're just going to vote straight Republican ticket instead of actually, you know, looking at the down ballot candidate.
John, does any of this sound familiar to your way of thinking?
It does. I'll answer the second one first, though. So I geek out on numbers. I get really excited to look at statistics and numbers and all of that. And the thing that is really that's really jumped out to me about Senator Sanders is almost all of his support is in urban areas. And if you look at Iowa and New Hampshire, he got whomped in rural areas. And if you see how successful he was in Nevada, it was all centered around urban areas. And every time we move out of a big city, he gets massacred. All of those votes went to Buttigieg and went to Klobuchar. And so what I look when I see that is that's great that he has such a strong base of support, but they're all in safe blue areas. And so can we run up the score there to supersede a lower turnout in rural areas? Possibly. But I also say that when you're playing for keeps, you shouldn't be risky.
Something that strikes me and something that a lot of progressives say is that if the status quo were acceptable, we would see the status quo running away with it right now. It's not happening. What we're seeing is actually a lot of people who seem to be saying, we need to do something that is really radical to change things if we intend to upend Donald Trump, given his support, his level of support. Does that ring true to either you, Rachel, or Rob? I mean, do you think that maybe there does need to be a break with the status quo in the Democratic Party?
I would think that if Sanders really wanted to change the status quo when it comes to the Democratic Party, he needs to be a Democrat. Him being an independent all these years in Vermont and then only being a Democrat when it comes to presidential runs, you know, he's just, if you want to change the system, you need to change the system from within and be a Democrat and change how we do things as Democrats, not come in as an outsider and try to upend us from the outside.
Rob, it sounds like the real factor here when it comes to being undecided heading into Super Tuesday largely comes down to the Sanders factor and what to do about it, given the fact that he's been so successful up to now. Am I right?
Yeah, I mean, to a certain degree. So kind of jumping off from both of the other two, everybody talks about Sanders supporters as progressives, but here's the thing. I don't see them as progressive so much as kind of a regressive left, basically kind of the left-wing version of the Tea Party. And I know they keep saying that, oh, no, no, that's not what we all are what we are at all. But I see ideological purity tests. I see he's not progressive enough. I mean, it's the same kind of speech that we heard from the Tea Party going back to 2009.
That's the voice of Rob Hughes of Richardson. We also heard from John Hawthorne Smith of Austin and Rachel Anthony of Plano. All three are undecided on this day before Super Tuesday here in Texas. Folks, thanks so much for taking a few minutes out to explain your positions to listeners of the Texas Standard. We certainly do appreciate it.
Thank you, David.
All right.
Thank you.
Well, let's find out what Texans are talking about on this day before Super Tuesday. Here's our social media editor, Wells Dunbar.
Hi, David. Several more reactions on our Facebook page from other undecided voters out there, like this comment from Andy Kirkendall. He writes that he's undecided in the sense that I want my vote to mean something. He goes on to say that if a presidential candidate is out of the running between early voting and election day, I will find it hard to justify voting for them. That's one reason I will be voting on the actual day and not earlier. And of course, we just saw this dynamic play out with Tom Steyer and Pete Buttigieg's candidacies closing up shop here, essentially, on the eve of Super Tuesday. Similarly, Nicole LeBlanc says, I am decided if my candidate is still in the race next Tuesday. That's why I haven't voted early either. Meanwhile, Pat P.K. Riley says they're undecided for a separate reason. The pool of possibilities is just too good. It's too hard to decide. Well, isn't that nice? Well, speaking of Buttigieg, lots more reactions to his departure from the race, along with Joe Biden's win in South Carolina and whether that can sustain his campaign going forward. Lots of politics talk going into Super Tuesday tomorrow.
Yeah, you know, we were talking with Elizabeth Warren just on Friday. She was saying she wants to keep in the battle all the way through the convention. That seems to be her strategy at this point. Just pick up as many delegates as you can and maybe keep somebody from running away with the majority. We'd love to hear what you think, Texas. Does our conversation a couple of minutes ago, does that resonate with you? Let us hear from you at Texas Standard. Wells back in 35.
Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas Association of Community Colleges, providing pathways for Texans to advance the individual aspirations of students while focusing on accessibility, affordability, and relevance. More at tacc.org. Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas College Savings Plan, administered by the state of Texas. Families can save for tuition, room and board, books, and other qualified education expenses at eligible schools nationwide. Learn more at texascollegesavings.com.
It's the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. There are several congressional races in Texas that promise to test whether and to what extent the Texas political picture is changing. Among them, the battle for TX-24, the congressional district in North Texas, which includes many suburbs in Dallas and Tarrant counties. A longtime Republican is retiring, and last week we heard about the parade of Democrats lining up to do battle. Today, Bill Ziebel introduces us to the Republicans, hoping to keep the district in GOP control.
Former Irving mayor and councilperson Beth Van Dyne most recently served 2.5 years in the Trump administration with HUD, Housing and Urban Development. She resigned to run for this seat.
You're going to have an adult in the room with me. You're going to have somebody who has a strong voice, will have a backbone, and will fight for the best interests of 24 for the state of Texas and for the country.
Van Dyne is controversial in part for the Irving resolution when she was mayor to bar Islamic Sharia law from taking hold in the U.S. That resolution ultimately failed in the Texas House. Some blasted Van Dyne's efforts, calling them anti-Muslim. Van Dyne says she was defending the U.S. Constitution and upholding American laws. Her four primary opponents for this seat, that includes parts of Tarrant, Dallas, and Denton counties, acknowledge Van Dyne is the leading Republican.
It's an uphill battle, to be honest.
It is an uphill battle. If you gauge most elections by who has the most money, she's already won the race.
She's huge, and she has a ton of money. It's appealing when you first glance at it.
I wouldn't have got into this if I thought there was no way to win.
We heard in order Sonny Schiaparella, Jaron Liverman, David Fagan, and Desi Mays. Schiaparella and Mays, both involved in construction, attack Van Dine for being a career politician, even though Donald Trump endorsed the former mayor.
She's the establishment. She's the swamp. She's everything he fought against.
They're going to D.C. They're taking money off the backs of us, and nothing's getting done.
Van Dine says she'll get things done thanks to her political experience. She wants affordable health care, better roads, and beefed up borders. Here's how she'd get that.
Closing loopholes and asylum laws that are allowing, child trafficking in our streets or allowing drug cartels to come in, looking at ways to secure the border.
Most candidates share those priorities. Jaron Liverman, though, says the father in him leads him to identify with all dads, including undocumented fathers.
It is complex for me. Yes, they're here illegally. My opponents would say they got to go back. It's a bigger problem than just sending people back to somewhere that they don't have anywhere to go back to. Therein lies my confliction.
David Fagan, who's 25 years old and in real estate, shows empathy toward immigrants if they're here legally.
I love immigrants, and that's why I speak Arabic and I speak Spanish. It's to invite incoming immigrants, the legal ones.
Fagan's top priority? He opposes abortion. The top priority for former Green Beret Desi Mays? A better business environment with fewer regulations.
Let's look at reducing more taxes for businesses. If we continue to reduce it, just like our President Donald Trump is doing, then it creates more jobs. I mean, I'm firsthand can tell you, people say trickle-down economics doesn't work. I can tell you it does.
In this presidential election year, the top of the ticket typically drives turnout for better or worse. And every Republican in this primary declares allegiance to President Trump. I'm Bill Ziebel in Dallas.
Support for coverage of business comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider committed to helping companies protect their drivers on the road. More at worksafetexas.com/onthejob.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. Well, the coronavirus continues to spread across the globe. Its effects have now reached the economy, too. Stock markets have taken a hit as fears have grown. Dow Jones Industrial Average just had its worst week since 2008. It's got the energy industry in disarray as well. Oil prices have dipped, and the energy industry's annual CERAWeek event in Houston this month has been called off over fears of the outbreak, and that's a pretty big deal. Here with an update on the state of the industry, Matt Smith. He's director of commodity research at Clipper Data. Matt, welcome back.
Thank you, David.
Did I get that right? CERAWeek is a place where you are seen, you come to be seen and to see others, meet other people in the energy industry and talk about the state of the industry.
Exactly, it's this event where all the big names turn up. It's a huge networking event. We actually had IP Week in London, and although that wasn't cancelled, we saw a number of events there cancelled, and so you're seeing this effect of coronavirus hitting all manner of different regions, geographies, and events. This is a big deal with CERAWeek being cancelled.
CERAWeek used to stand for Cambridge Energy Research Associates, I believe, was where the CERA and CERAWeek comes from. So you have that cancelled. We were talking about the coronavirus and oil prices just a couple of weeks ago. Mm-hmm. What's happened since?
Well, last time we chatted, David, WTI, that U.S. benchmark, was treading water about the $50 a barrel mark after it swiftly dropped by about $10 at the back half of January. In the last week, however, as equity markets have sold off violently, as you mentioned there, we've seen the coronavirus spreading to new countries and regions. We've seen renewed selling in the oil market and is pushed to test the lows of late 2018.
Wow. So what are we talking about now? We're talking about in the $40 range?
Yeah, so we got to the low 40s. But as you see now, as the equity markets are getting a bit of a bounce today, you're seeing the same thing with the crude side of things too. It's that, rising tide raises all boats.
Mm-hmm.
So it's that broader market sentiment. So we're getting a bit of a bounce here, but still well lower from where we were sort of mid-January, which was sort of $60 a barrel.
So this has got to be hurting producers. What about the effect on gasoline prices?
Well, it is having an impact, but it's not sort of crushing them. So what we're seeing is Texas retail prices at $2.12 a gallon. That's actually just a couple of cents below month ago levels. While you would expect a drop in oil prices to work their way into prices at the pump, this is actually the most bullish time of the year for gasoline. And the reason I say that is because we see production offline as refineries undergo maintenance to prepare for the summer driving season. And we're also seeing the switch to summer blend gasoline as well, which typically causes a bit of a jump at the pump because those additives in the summer blend are more expensive. But this time around, what we've seen is essentially the increase at the pump has been offset by the downward pressure we've seen because of the coronavirus on the price of oil.
Does a lot of this have to do with future speculation? I mean, what could turn around oil and gasoline prices? How much of this is a sort of fear reaction, a sort of anticipation that there may be more bad news to come?
Well, the demand dent is real. So you're seeing that in China, you're seeing it in Asia, where the brunt of the coronavirus has hit. So you are seeing it showing up there. But what you see in commodity prices generally is this emotional reaction. It gets that bad news priced in straight away. So this sell-off that we've seen doesn't necessarily mean that the demand has dropped off now, but the fear of that happening has caused that negativity towards pricing.
Any reason to be optimistic? Because this sounds like a rather glum outlook.
Well, the one supportive influence that we'll see this week likely is going to come from OPEC. And they're set to meet later this week in Vienna, and they're likely to announce a deeper production cut to try and halt this price slide.
Matt Smith is Director of Commodity Research at Clipper Data, and he continues to monitor all these fluctuations. Matt, good to talk with you again. We'll talk with you again in a couple of weeks.
Yep, sounds great. Thanks very much.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas A&M University, one of 17 U.S. universities with a land grant, sea grant, and space grant designation. Texas A&M University, fearless on every front. More at fearlessfront.com. Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas CASA, advocating for a safe and positive future for all Texas children in the child protection system. Volunteer information at becomeacasa.org. Every child has a chance. It's you.
From the Texas Newsroom, I'm Joseph Leahy. The U.S. Supreme Court says it will take up a legal challenge to the Affordable Care Act led by Texas. The state scored a victory to overturn the ACA last year in the U.S. Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals. In December, a three-judge panel ruled the individual mandate requiring all Americans to get health insurance unconstitutional. The Supreme Court's decision to weigh the ruling this fall means it will not issue a decision until after the 2020 election. Governor Greg Abbott is calling on federal officials to keep people quarantined at Lackland Air Force Base for longer than originally planned to prevent potentially exposing the public to coronavirus. During a press conference this morning, Abbott criticized the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention for briefly releasing a COVID-19 patient in San Antonio before returning them to isolation. The patient had two negative tests before a third came back positive. Abbott says those quarantined should be held until protocols improve.
Our demand and our expectation is those people will not be allowed to go home today. They will not be allowed to go home until the CDC can guarantee that they have no trace of coronavirus and pose no threat to the expansion of the coronavirus anywhere in the country.
Abbott is demanding the CDC increase the number of tests required before releasing patients from two taken 24 hours apart to three tests taken 48 hours apart. Tomorrow, March 3rd, is Election Day for the 2020 primaries in Texas. As KUT's Matt Largy says, a lot of Texans already cast ballots during the early voting period, which ended Friday.
More than 2 million Texans voted early this time. About the same number of Democrats as Republicans. Slightly more Republicans voted early in the primary, though they don't really have a contested presidential primary. A lot of the down ballot congressional races and local races is what's driving turnout on that side. The Democrats, of course, have a pretty contested presidential primary, and things obviously changed over the weekend with the South Carolina primary and Joe Biden winning that. So it'll be interesting to see what effect, if any, that has on turnout and the outcome tomorrow.
And meanwhile, former Vice President Joe Biden is campaigning in Texas today. Houston Public Media's Sasha Kortner has more.
Former Vice President Joe Biden will be in Houston today. He's holding a community event at Texas Southern University at 1 this afternoon, followed by a second one in Dallas at around 7:30 tonight. Businessman Tom Steyer was supposed to be in Houston today as well for a town hall, but after dropping his presidential bid over the weekend, the event was canceled.
And the polls open in Texas at 7 a.m. Tuesday. I'm Joseph Leahy for the Texas Standard.
33 minutes past the hour, Texas Standard Time. I'm David Brown. The NFL season is over. The NFL season has just started. Certainly seems like we're never completely without football. That's something Darren Roberts knows better than most. He's the founding director of the Center for Sports Leadership and Innovation at the University of Texas at Austin, not to mention a former NFL and college football coach himself. Welcome back, Darren. Good to see you, sir.
Dave, always great to be on.
The Super Bowl happened about a month ago, but there is somehow more NFL news to talk about. You just got back from Indianapolis where you were at the NFL Draft Combine, I understand.
Yes.
For the uninitiated, what's the Cliff Notes version of what the Draft Combine is?
So the Combine brings in really the upper crust of the draft eligible players. Mm-hmm. And there are a series of workouts from the 40-yard dash to the cone drill, the vertical leap. And it is a way for scouts and coaches of the 32 NFL teams mm-hmm. to take some time to evaluate the talent that's coming up for the next draft.
I understand this is the first year the NFL has actually broadcast these drills in primetime.
Yes.
First of all, I'm a little surprised that there'd be an audience for something like this. I mean, people lifting weights and running the 40-yard dash and that kind of thing. But does it change? Do you think that changes the nature of the event in any substantial way?
The NFL has always had this uncanny ability to monetize every single aspect of the business. And so when I coached, it was a sleepy event, and you may turn on the TV to watch a player from your college run the 40-yard dash. Now it's in prime time. And I think what you're going to see is that the NFL will start to mandate that all 32 teams attend the combine. Hmm. This year, the Los Angeles Rams and the Denver Broncos sent limited staff members mm-hmm. because in reality, you have all the digital footage from everything that happens in Indianapolis.
So you can watch it in your own free time if you wanted to.
Absolutely. Every team will get full downloads of all of the workouts that took place. But this is an opportunity for the NFL to monetize this interest that has been generated around college players who are about to hit the NFL scene.
Very interesting. Yeah. Well, off the field, NFL owners and the players union are negotiating a new collective bargaining agreement. A recent version of the deal included a bump in pay for the players in exchange for adding a 17th regular season game. What do you think the players make of all this?
You know, this is the same play as it is with the combine. The owners want to squeeze as much value as they can out of a regular season. And so the proposal now is one in which, currently you have 4 preseason games, mm-hmm. 16 regular season games.
Yeah.
The owners want to carve out one of those preseason games, go down to 3.
Okay.
And then increase the regular season games.
I see.
Up
okay.
to 17.
Okay, so they're not extending the season or anything. Yeah.
Exactly. But from a player perspective, the one thing that you know is that there is a very different speed and aggression between a preseason and a regular season game.
Mm-hmm.
So to add another game is going to create tremendous physical toll. I mean, this is not a slight move. And so this is why you saw the executive committee from the NFLPA vote 6-5 to not recommend that Ooh. This go towards the full player body.
Mm-hmm.
This could be something that could force sort of an extended lockout if there isn't some negotiation that takes place.
I have to say, it's kind of remarkable that the season's been over for almost a month and basketball and hockey are in full swing. Baseball's about to start, but we're still talking about the NFL, right? I guess that's the league's goal, right? I mean, they want to own the calendar.
They do. And, you know, the NFL has weathered quite a storm. If you look at the last decade, the Ray Rice episode, Colin Kaepernick, you know, there were many who thought that basketball may take over that number one spot. But revenue has continued to go up and to the right. And for some reason, America and the globe just can't get enough of the National Football League.
Is this ultimately healthy for the league, or does it need to now start thinking about rolling it back, dialing it back a bit?
We're in an interesting time because you're seeing healthy players retire early. The Gronkowskis, Kuechly with the Panthers. I think that you're going to, and we talked about this 17, you know, the proposal to move to 17 games. I think the NFL leadership has to be very careful about the way that it approaches these negotiations with players, because I think a lot of players are saying, hey, listen, I'm going to give you 5 to 6 years of my body and time, effort and toil. You've got concussions and injuries that are impacting their long-term security. And it could be a time in which you may see, you're seeing football participation go down across the country. So, you know, it's up and to the right now in terms of interest, but I would not be surprised if we see some dip, if this, especially over this collective bargaining agreement, if we can't come to a good resolution.
Darren Roberts is the founding director of the Center for Sports Leadership and Innovation at the University of Texas at Austin. Darren, good to see you again, sir. Thanks
Likewise.
So much for stopping in.
Thank you.
Support for Texas Standard comes from TCU, where Horned Frogs strive to be responsible world citizens. More on how a trip to Norway challenged students' perspectives on mass incarceration and justice at tcu.edu/stories. Support comes from Texas Children's Hospital, focused on outcomes and care, and providing treatment to kids in the Lone Star State and beyond for more than 60 years. Texas Children's Hospital, personalized care for every child. More at texaschildrens.org.
Hi, I'm Emily Pennington, and I am a journalist and travel writer with Outside Magazine. Almost 10 years ago, the National Park Survey started a big accessibility initiative, and I realized for people who maybe had strollers or wheelchairs or just mobility issues where they couldn't go up and down stairs, there wasn't a great central list of the top trails in the national parks or just in the country at large. We came up with this idea of doing this huge bucket list of accessible trails. We took into account things like surface stability, the cross slope of the trail, so that your wheels aren't going to run off into a ditch, accessible parking, and then the trail grade. First of all, the South Rim Trail in the Grand Canyon in Arizona is absolutely incredible. In Yosemite, there is a valley floor loop trail. It's a multi-use trail, which means it's designed for people to be able to bicycle on, but you are allowed to take a wheelchair on it as well. That one was a big fan favorite. Badwater Basin Salt Flats in Death Valley is kind of a cool one because it's only a trail for the first, I don't even know, maybe 0.1 or 0.2 miles. It's a boardwalk with some signs about how the salt flats were formed. And then you actually roll out off trail onto this very flat desert floor, and you can see these kind of crackling hexagonal salt formations, and you get an amazing view of Telescope Peak. In Sequoia National Park, there is one called the Big Trees Trail. There are frequently like bear and deer sightings in the area, and it gets you up close and personal with dozens of these giant mature sequoia trees. Actually, I had the good fortune of being able to be in Big Bend, so I just saw this trail in person, which was really special. So the Window View Trail in the Chisos Mountains are volcanic mountains, so they were formed by big volcanic eruptions and fault movements. There's trees, there's mountains, it's this total island in the sky feeling compared to the Chihuahuan Desert area of the park that surrounds the Chisos Mountains. And make sure you do not confuse the Window View Trail, which is accessible, with its cousin, the Window Trail, which is about 4 miles and not accessible, but also gorgeous. I believe that there's no greater time than the present to foster a deeper emotional connection with our public lands and our national parks so that we can continue to support them for future generations. And I think that doesn't just apply to able-bodied people or to people who are like white and middle class. I think it applies to everyone. And so if I can use my privilege as a journalist to put more information out in the world so that other people can enjoy the parks, then that's all I could ever hope for. This is Emily Pennington. I'm a writer for Outside Magazine, and you're listening to the Texas Standard.
Past the hour, Texas Standard Time. I'm David Brown. Each year, the San Antonio Stock Show and Rodeo also puts on a contest that quietly recognizes talents that don't require a saddle or throwing a lariat. Texas Public Radio's Jack Morgan on the surprising double winner of this year's Student Western Art Contest.
What a ride! What a ride!
The rodeo is known for its bronc riding, its massive carnival, and your chance to get up close and personal with horses. But every year there's also a competition less dangerous than the 8-second ride, yet for some, still quite thrilling.
It's the Western Art Contest.
The rodeo's Diana Turner has managed the contest its entire 24-year run and says it's for high school students only.
They can be in public school or a homeschool environment, but they do have to be in high school.
They recognize artistic talent and turn that talent into scholarship money for winning students' college education.
This year, we gave away 17 scholarships totaling $90,000.
Artists create content honoring Western heritage in its many iterations, and hundreds do.
Last year we had about 402. This year I think we had 360.
Best of show winners have traditionally been paintings and drawings, but that tradition was broken in 2018.
Last year is the first year we've ever had a sculpture piece win Best of Show.
And that break with tradition continued this year.
And then we had it 2 years in a row, same student, very talented student.
I am Brenna Richardson.
Brenna is that student. Their choice of her last year took her by surprise.
They pulled me aside. They said, "This is the first time in 23 years that we've chosen a sculpture to win." I felt very honored to hold that title.
The 17-year-old has only entered into art contests 4 times, at which she's won 4 awards, the least of which was 2nd place.
I almost don't feel worthy. You picked my piece?
Last year's entry was called Flow and made entirely of clay.
Horses kind of running down a hill in sort of a river. And down at the end, the horses themselves are liquefying and becoming part of the river.
Her father, Mike Richardson, recalls how the producer of Houston's Young Artist Contest saw Flo beforehand.
When he saw what was on that table, he just said, "You get her to the show. This girl's got something."
Apparently she does. And he says she didn't get her creativity from him.
I'm an investment advisor, so yes. I'm on the other side of that. I don't have the creative gene.
Richardson says she took to working in clay early on.
It almost like it spills out of her. Her classmates in this gallery are just astounded that in 2 hours she can have a working study of something that just takes your breath away.
That gallery is the New Braunfels Art League downtown.
I've been taking lessons under Trace Guthrie for the last going on 3 years now, and it's really changed everything. What I really like about Trace is he tells everyone, "You're the pilot. I'm just here to help."
She's a little firecracker.
Teacher Trace Guthrie.
She thinks visually, and she can really see what she's doing. She's got a real good eye.
She trained that eye on this year's Student Western Art Contest, and like last year's entry, she chose an action shot, also featuring a horse.
Horses are hilarious. They decide, "Oh, this rock looks scary," and they spook. And they jump backwards, and you have this horrible moment of fear, and then you try to collect yourself and calm each other down. But I wanted to try and capture that moment.
Capture it, she did. Though for this piece called Spooked, it's a jackrabbit that caused the spook. She could have created a tranquil horse scene, but the drama gave it an edge.
Absolutely. It's more visually stimulating and interesting.
And like last year, this year she won Best of Show.
As good as her piece was last year, I can see an improvement this year. I think she's very talented, and I think she's going to go a long ways.
Which begs the question, what's next?
She's got to finish high school. We got to do SATs. We got to get college prep going. We got to all those things. So she's busy, and she'll stay busy as long as she wants to do it, if she's passionate about it.
I have no idea what the future holds for me.
One thing for sure, college, a good chunk of which will already be paid for because of the scholarships.
We just looked at Texas State and St. Edward's University. I think I'd want to stay in Texas and be close to home.
She has concerns about the unsure world of professional art, but it's also got quite an allure.
Despite all the issues, I think I want to try to make a career out of it.
And unlike most college art students, she already has commission work, a waiting list of people ready to pay her for her sculptures. I'm Jack Morgan in San Antonio.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Rand Group, partnering with SAP to help mid-sized companies streamline operations such as CRM, finance, and procurement. More at randgroup.com. Software delivered as promised. No surprises. Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas Oncology, whose research has helped bring more than 85 cancer-fighting drugs to the marketplace. Patients can access national clinical trials, phases 1-4, in their communities. More at texasoncology.com.
Hey, it's a Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. In past presidential election cycles, one city that's gotten less than its fair share of attention from the candidates is the one so far from the other major cities in Texas. It's in a whole nother time zone. But a funny thing happened on the way to the primaries this year. Candidates wanted to make sure to stop in El Paso. Well, could the biggest city in West Texas be a game changer in the 2020 elections? KERA's Mallory Falk reports.
When presidential hopeful Bernie Sanders held a recent campaign rally in El Paso, it made sense to kick things off with the beloved local band Sparta. The group played a few songs as people took their seats in a downtown concert hall. Then frontman Jim Ward addressed the crowd.
I'm a fourth generation El Pasoan. We have a dilemma. We have a thought that we're not as important as the rest of the world sometimes.
That's wrong, Ward said.
Thank you so much to this campaign for coming here just to say that this town is important.
Sanders' campaign stop was somewhat unusual.
Generally, the only way you see a presidential candidate in El Paso is when they land here to drive to Las Cruces.
Richard Panetta teaches political communication at the University of Texas at El Paso. He's referring to a nearby town in New Mexico, which has long been considered a battleground state. Panetta says there's a potentially apocryphal story about then-presidential candidate John Kerry stopping to eat in a town that straddles state lines.
Somebody realized they were on the Texas side and that they scurried across the street to the New Mexico side to make sure that they got in their New Mexico vote plug.
Whether or not that story is actually true, Pineda says it captures a true feeling about where El Paso stands on candidates' priority lists. He says El Paso is typically ignored by both parties. It's a deep blue county, so not a place where Republicans focus much attention. And Democratic candidates are more likely to stop in larger, wealthier cities with larger, wealthier donor bases.
It boils down to money, quite frankly.
But this election cycle is different. President Trump has made El Paso ground zero for his immigration rhetoric and new immigration policies. Just over a year ago, he came to the border city to launch his reelection campaign.
We started a big, beautiful wall right on the Rio Grande. Right smack on the Rio Grande.
Soon after, another candidate kicked off his presidential bid in El Paso. Former Congressman Beto O'Rourke offered a very different vision of his hometown.
We are safe, not despite the fact that we are a city of immigrants and asylum seekers. We are safe because we are a city of immigrants and asylum seekers.
Then in August, a mass shooting at a local Walmart thrust the city back in the spotlight. Police say the suspect drove hundreds of miles to El Paso from a Dallas suburb and that he claimed the shooting was a response to, quote, the Hispanic invasion of Texas. Many here say the president's rhetoric put a target on El Paso and fueled the attack. All this led some to wonder whether more candidates might focus on the city. Again, here's Richard Panetta.
It provides them the stage to be able to launch, I think, a very full-throated attack against the Republican position on guns or on violence or potentially even the conversation on immigration. You can use El Paso as a focal point to counterbalance the Republican narrative.
So is that actually happening? The answer is sort of. Two candidates held campaign rallies here ahead of Super Tuesday, Senator Sanders and former New York Mayor Mike Bloomberg, who also opened a field office here. Panetta says in past election cycles, that would have been unthinkable. But other candidates are focusing on the more expected cities. Elizabeth Warren spent the run-up to Super Tuesday in San Antonio and Houston. Joe Biden opened offices in other major Texas cities, but not El Paso. None of this is surprising, says Enriqueta Triana, a veteran who lined up early to nab a seat at the Sanders rally. When it comes to presidential candidates,
I think we're sometimes the last the last ones that they consider. It'd be nice if, you know, they would think of us first sometimes.
She's excited that her preferred candidate did think of El Paso this time. That for one politician, her city is on the map. I'm Mallory Falk in El Paso.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. All right, our social media editor, Wells Dunbar, is back in the house with what Texans are talking about on this Monday. What are you hearing out there?
Well, politics watchers on overtime heading into Super Tuesday. Mm-hmm. No surprise there. But one topic, mentioned this earlier, Pete Buttigieg suspending his presidential campaign, making history as the first openly gay major presidential candidate for the Democratic nomination there. Here's some of what we're seeing online via our Facebook page. Chelsea Chance says, what a statesman. He did what was right for the party and the country at this point in time and predicts he has a bright future in politics and will be better for it. John Michael Tullis, sort of calling back to our undecided voters earlier on the program, mm-hmm. He says that he early voted for Pete. Oh, well, I literally threw away my vote this time, he writes. The other big news from the presidential primary season this weekend was Joe Biden's win in South Carolina, widely expected. But still, by one win was by a very decisive margin. Mm-hmm. On our Facebook page, Pat Snow is a Biden supporter and applauds his big win. But Matt Weiss predicts that South Carolina was Biden's last hurrah. He focused 100% of his energy there and fell flat everywhere else. It won't save him. Called back to our panel of those undecided voters just a moment ago and another comment about that. This one via Twitter from Abraham Davenport. He chimes in with that panel, we managed to find several people who hate Bernie but interviewed zero supporters, despite the fact that Sanders is leading the race.
You see, there's the concept thing here. It wasn't about talking with
Bernie supporters.
Bernie supporters. Yeah. Yes, it was about undecided people who haven't any real sense of where they're going to pull the lever.
And again, it goes to that question of the various reasons the folks are undecided for. You know, I've seen some people who do support a Sanders candidacy, mm-hmm. but they have these questions about electability and whatnot. Sure. Yeah. So yeah, lots to go over there.
Yeah, it's really interesting whether Mr. Biden's momentum is going to be enough to put up a challenge to Bernie Sanders, we're talking about there, mm-hmm. because 14 states are going to be part of this Super Tuesday thing that's happening tomorrow. So it's going to be a big deal. And by the way, just in case you happen to be around a wireless set or, of course, an internet device, we're going to be broadcasting updates throughout the evening as the vote comes in from across the Lone Star State. So you can get your NPR, which is sort of your fix of what's happening nationwide, and you don't have to leave out what's happening in Texas either. So it's going to be some very interesting reporting from the Standard and from our partners across the Lone Star State.
That's right, a historic evening in the offing tomorrow night, Super Tuesday.
Make sure you join us.
Well, speaking of big days, I guess today is somewhat of a big day, March 2nd.
Oh, I happen to know what happened.
Seeing a few tweets there. Yeah, I got one from Jeremiah, who says March 2nd is Texas Independence Day.
That's
why didn't anyone celebrate this weekend? Any fireworks, parties, parades?
What, you didn't do any fireworks this weekend?
No, I'm still...
still recovering from
still
New Year's.
Still recovering from New Year's.
Of course.
And our pal Priscilla via Twitter, she says, happy Texas Independence Day. A special day here for the Standard as well.
Because
that's when we kind of got our start as well many years ago.
Amen. That's right. About 5 years back, I believe it was. Hey, listen, we're out of time for the big broadcast, but we're going to be back here tomorrow. Very, very busy news day indeed. And don't forget, if you haven't cast your ballot, you're going to want to get out there and do so tomorrow, Super Tuesday Day. We're going to be back here tomorrow. We hope you'll join us then. Till then, I'm David Brown along with Wells Dunbar and the rest of the team wishing you a marvelous Monday.
Philanthropic support for Texas Standard comes from Casey and Scott O'Hare, the Winkler Family Foundation, Lynn Dobson and Greg Wooldridge, Adrian Killam, and the George Huntington Family.